Hi, I'm Brian Grant, and you're listening to On Time, the Brian Grant Foundation podcast about living with Parkinson's. If you want to know more about Brian Grant Foundation, go to briangrant.org.
Hi, this is Katrina Call, Executive Director of the Brian Grant Foundation. Thank you for listening to our podcast, which is one of our many programs to help empower people impacted by Parkinson's disease to lead active and fulfilling lives. Our programs are possible because of the generous support of our donors. Please consider helping us continue this work by making a donation at briangrant.org. Thanks again for listening.
Hi there. Welcome to On Time, the podcast brought to you by the Brian Grant Foundation. I'm your host, Larry Gifford, president and co-founder of PD Avengers. And I'm thrilled to kick off this series of discussions focusing on Parkinson's disease, stigma, and the journey towards understanding and acceptance. At the Brian Grant Foundation, we're dedicated to empowering those living with Parkinson's to live active and fulfilling lives. Through this podcast, we aim to shine a spotlight on important topics surrounding Parkinson's, starting with the pervasive issue of stigma. Throughout this series, we'll be diving deep into conversations with experts, advocates, and individuals directly impacted by Parkinson's stigma, exploring its impact on various aspects of life, from work to relationships and beyond. Together, we'll challenge misconceptions, foster understanding, and pave the way towards a more inclusive and supportive future. So whether you're living with Parkinson's, supporting someone who is, or simply curious to learn more, we invite you to join us on this journey. Let's dive in and explore the complexities of Parkinson's stigma together, right here on Time. Our first guest is licensed psychologist and a person with Parkinson's, Dr. Kimball Magone. Kimball, you're on time.
Hey, how you doing, Larry?
Good. Welcome to On Time.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Nice to be here.
Let's start at the basics, the very beginning. When people talk about stigma, it can mean a myriad of things. How do you define stigma?
Well, to me, stigma is basically a social phenomenon, right? And there's a set of unfair and negative beliefs attributed to a set of persons, okay? And so you've got the external stigma, and then you have a process that people are vulnerable to, which is internal stigma, right? Self-stigma. So there are different layers to that. And then just to add one last thing, the core emotion that comes from stigma is shame.
Mm. So let's talk about the U.S. What are some of the ways stigma presents itself for people with Parkinson's in the U.S.?
Well, I think if you look at it as a cultural kind of contextual, from a cultural contextual point of view, you've got a country which is really founded on rugged individualism, right? You remember that? The Marlboro cowboy on the horse with the rifle.
Oh, yeah.
He's all by himself, right? It's really, he gets it that we're not as much a collective society as we are. And it's got its plus and minuses, obviously, but we're a very individualistic culture. So there's a kind of a, on one level, there's a tendency to judge anybody who's not in the tribe the way they supposedly should be. And that intersects, too, with the religious orientation of Calvinism and Puritan. That people came over early, right, 1600s and earlier, came over and really had a very austere kind of idea about what normalcy was, right? And any deviation from that was punished. So there's that level. And then there's the level of that shame serves a function, just like every other emotion in my book, right? Joy, happiness, anger, jealousy, you know. Shame is really a signal from the brain that you're getting put outside the tribe. And I think PWP, of which I am one, they said 50% of PWP have experienced active discrimination because of their difference, right? And then there's also myths about what Parkinson's is, you know, Larry, right? There's these popular myths that are kind of positioned by the culture, and that's something we have to break through.
So how have you been discriminated against?
Well, one time I was in a club, right, listening to music about a year ago with my wife, and we were having a great time, and I got up and went over to the bar to get a drink, and there was a guy sitting next to me. There were a couple of empty glasses in my body. You know, my spatial orientation isn't beautiful, okay, to say the least. So what I did is my elbow knocked over the couple glasses. And the guy reacted, you know, no sense of maybe what's going on with this guy, but just, you know, very hostily. And I just said, oh, I was, this was a year ago. So I've already been through the, grief and dealing with all that stuff years ago, really, about what I need to do. So I said, oh, don't let it bother you. I've got Parkinson's. And then his eyes lit up, you know, and I said, I've got Parkinson's. And so it's fine. I got it. But I really am sorry about that drink. Can I buy you one? And then he said, you got Parkinson's? And then we had a nice discussion. It was like,
oh, good. So you turned it into a learning experience.
That's right. Well, that's easy to say 10 years in because you've done the work, right? As you know, you've done the work to get where you're at, right?
Let's go back to your first year or our first years. You know, when you talk about stigma and self-stigma, especially, a lot of people are afraid to tell people because of the stigma they're expecting to come at them.
That's right. And you know what's real interesting about that, Larry, because I've got a lot of PWP in my practice. I'm a private practitioner, have been for 35 years, and I have a lot of PWP clients, and they really talk about, you know, the difficulties they encounter socially. And what I've noticed is when they're working in therapy, so I do individual and family therapy and couples therapy, and when they kind of get in it, you know, when they start to build self-acceptance and grieve what they were and get tuned into what they can be, right? There's a grief process. And once they get self-acceptant, then they're able to re-enter the tribe because they don't put themselves down about it. They don't shame themselves anymore. They realize this is just the arbitrary crap of life that happens, right? And everybody gets a dose, you know, everybody gets something. That's something I've found in 35 years of practice, plus knowing many people, right? Everybody's got something. But when you're first diagnosed, it's like, I've got something, everybody else is okay. That's the myth that we carry because we're trying to process the necessary loss that needs to happen. And if you grieve it, then you're up for post-traumatic growth. You know, that's a very important concept now.
Post-traumatic growth,
right.
Wow. So it's not PTSD, it's PTG.
And I tell you, post-traumatic growth is a big area of research right now, the last 2 to 5 years. And it's about people coming back from trauma, right? Severe illness, diagnosis, et cetera. Coming back from trauma and being able to not just come back to baseline, right? Which is resiliency, but to go further. They become qualitatively different. You might be able to relate to that. I can.
I can, for sure.
You become more empathic. If you embrace it, you deal with it. You become more empathic, the research shows. You become better at prioritizing. You get a feeling of steeliness that if I can deal with this, I can deal with anything, right? You get more involved with other people and realize that everybody suffers. It's really, post-traumatic growth is really possible, and the research on that is really excellent.
That's amazing. Okay, so let's dive into a couple of these things. How does stigma manifest for people with Parkinson's in regards to race or ethnicity?
Well, I think it's tougher because there's already enough stigma to go around, right? So it's a double felt injury, right? If you're already a marginalized group in some way, then you have that to deal with plus the second, and it aggravates and just makes it tougher. Because at least if you and I are having trouble with our tremors or whatever else, we can go to a boxing club and we got entree, right? We just go and do our thing. It's not so easy access. And for women, the treatment they get is not as good as what guys get. So there's that issue too.
Yeah, women particularly have some problems because they've been treating them as people with Parkinson's instead of women with Parkinson's for a long time.
Well said.
And so we're going to dive into that a little later in the series as well. And then there's socioeconomic status, which keeps you from having access to medical care and whatnot.
That's right. There's the poverty issue and the idea of getting substandard care or no care, right? And we have to educate, obviously you're all about this, we have to educate clinicians to be tuned into all of this, right? And to approach PWP as whole individuals with certain concentric circles of bias and stigma that they have to deal with. Everybody's got some layers.
Well, it's interesting because they'll tell you that no two people are alike who have Parkinson's, but they won't treat us. They'll treat us all the same.
One size fits all, which is a bunch of crap. thank God, the thing that's happening is medicine is becoming more personalized. You know, it's like Lori Mishley and the Seattle group, you know, it's just like a whole other level of approach. It's a matter of fact, they encouraged all the clinicians, neurologists, PTs, et cetera, to prescribe social action, to prescribe like on a pad. You get involved with, here's a list of the support groups. Here's a list of the exercise groups. Here's a list of the PT. So, you know, I want you to get into social involvement because the research in the last 3 years, actually, Mishley and Dusumbaranian from UCLA, they've done all this work on social interest in the power of social connection. So, you know, stigma gets in the way of people seeking that out, right? They don't seek out the groups they need. And the research on that shows that social interaction and social connection is more powerful than anything in terms of doing a group exercise, et cetera, et cetera. That the connectivity also is an antidote to shame. That's for sure.
How can education and awareness initiatives help combat stigma related to Parkinson's?
Well, I think people are well-meaning, okay, but they need to be desensitized to their fear. The education, the beauty of education is it can help reduce fear because knowledge is, you know, it provides insight and that one's fear can be diminished. If people are less afraid, then they'll be more receptive. So we have to find ways to get to everybody to learn about this and include people in the activities and in the you know, organizational structures that provide Parkinson's services. We really need to get everybody over their fear, right? Because it's really a fear of mortality unconsciously. It really is. It's like, oh God, I'm marked now, you know? And
yeah, right. Yeah.
I've got the big, you know, X on my head or whatever, you know?
I was just going to say that I think it's interesting that the education one-on-one is actually more potent than one-on-many. And so if you just tell your story to your neighbor, it will have a profound impact on your neighbor. But if your neighbor is one of 1,000 people in a room, it's not going to hit them.
That's right. And we what we can do is, like you're doing, is spread the word, get people tuned in, help people build self-acceptance, because then they can re-engage the tribe that they feel exiled from, right? The social norms. They can transcend that if they have self-acceptance, right? I can go into a restaurant at this point, and it's like, you know, and if I have my pills I got to take, right? I just take my pill box, I stick it on my plate.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just like all about it to desensitize people. And somebody might say something once in a while. They go, oh, you okay? And I go, well, you got a minute? I'm kind of okay. And I'm kind of dealing with it, you know? And that's what we all have to do about something, right? Everybody's got something.
Stigma actually is impacting mental health, too. I mean, it's a mental health disease.
It's huge. It's huge. The depression, the non-motor symptoms come from stigma and shame. The research on that is clear. You know, people are diminished. They don't seek out treatment. You know, it's just, it's horrendous, really.
Have you faced yourself, you hired yourself, right? So you don't work for anybody, but a lot of people have workplace issues with stigma. How can employers create more inclusive and supportive environments for employees with Parkinson's?
Well, it's going to start with their mindset, Larry, right?
Yeah.
They've got to be open. Or somebody's got to be creative and offer an incentive for them to get involved, right? For some part of the organization, whatever company it is, let's say, for example, that if somebody's open, you know, to being approached by legitimate, you know, Parkinson's experts and people who are skilled in business, you know, interface, right? Really pulling out all the players on the bench. Right. Everybody has got skills. Right. I've got certain skills about psychotherapy with PWP. You have all sorts of skills with organization and vision and getting everybody to coordinate and then getting businesses involved, offering some kind of incentive. I mean, that's not my area, but I know enough about social systems dealing with family therapy and, you know, consulting with different organizations, et cetera, around different clinical issues. I do a lot of speaking. And I get a chance to influence. I spend one-on-one time with people who are curious, who, you know, say, hey, would you come and speak? I heard you speak. Would you come and speak? I'll do that for nothing. You know, I'll do that you know, for just pro bono, because I've got a great life. I don't need any.
Look at you.
Yeah. No, it's just,
you've overcome your stigmas.
Can I tell you? Right on.
That's great. That is great. I'm going to put you to work here.
Yeah.
A lot of people that need help and you can't help them all, but here's an opportunity. What strategies can people with Parkinson's use to cope with and navigate stigma in their daily lives?
In their daily life, what strategy can they use? That's an easy one, I'll tell you. What they need to do is they need to get into counseling or therapy, or they need to, either the research shows resilient people take risks. It can be a small risk. It can be making a phone call to a PWP organization, right? It can be doing virtual participation in support groups, right? So they can hide behind the mute and be safe, right? The idea is to make people feel safe and respected, and then they'll work on stuff. I've had many people who are just in the throes of the grief of their diagnosis, and if they work that through, then they can deal with the stigma. They have to first deal with the internal stigma and the loss. They had to go through the six stages of grief, right?
In
the six stages of grief aren't always linear.
No.
Step three comes up. Step four, you know, it comes back and forth. We go through a personal hell of realizing that getting from, you know, why me to why not me, you know?
Yeah, I'm there. It's like this. I was there. I was at the why me stage, and I'm like, well, why not me?
That's right. Then you get to a place, you work it through, you go, this isn't personal. This is just arbitrary crap of life. You know, everybody gets something, and this is mine. So you get to that place. So to answer your question, they can deal with stigma strategically by following the research, right? Get into counseling, getting your diet together, right? Mishley, all her work on diet and progression. Get the social interest. You know, Mishley and her colleagues have done tons of research on social interest. You know, the negative impact, I want to read this to you. The negative impact of loneliness, on symptom severity was as large as the positive effect from exercise.
Wow. Well, and I'll tell you, there's probably 50% of the population of PWPs that are living by themselves and not getting out.
That is shown to be accelerated progression and severity of symptoms are much higher.
Yeah, so get out there and do something.
And it leads to no accessing of services, because shame is a fundamental kind of emotion, and it's very global. It takes over one's life. So you got to get somebody. If you're a partner, you got to be tough and say, I love you, but you know, we need to go see someone, right? We need to go to the exercise class just one time. We'll make it safe. Just go once and sit in and watch. You know, just kind of systematic desensitization, they call it, right? A little bit at a time. But the partners and family have to get their input, right? Their help to deal with their acceptance and their fears as well. So the bottom line is people have to take a risk, and some people need some extra support to take that risk. You know, a therapist, you know, I have one client, he finally went to a boxing class and he loves it, but it took 6 months to, you know, get him to resolve enough of his fear in the likely outcomes, right? And since cognitive behavior therapy, right? You know, the idea that you have cognitions that keep you trapped in your shell, you have to shift those ways of thinking, you know, with treatment, right? With counseling or support, or if it's a PT group, you know, that's wonderful too. I mean, there's many ways to be social with PWP. And that social factor is number one. Loneliness is number one.
I'm sure a lot of people have heard of cognitive behavior therapy, but I don't know that they know what it is. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, you bet. It's kind of like this. You got two guys driving down the street, right? One guy cuts the other guy off. He's in a rush. The guy driving who got cut off, how he thinks about that is going to determine his mood and his reactivity. For example, if he says to himself, self-talk-wise, right? Cognitive behavior therapy helps people get in touch with their self-talk. Guides all of us all the time, even if we're not conscious of it. The one guy says to himself, oh God, the guy's probably a drunk. I'll just go behind and just let him go. I'm not going to make anything, you know, hand signals or anything else. I'm just going to, it doesn't matter. It's no big deal. How do you think that guy feels after that?
Pretty good.
Okay. And then there's the next guy. his self-talk is, that's a personal insult to me. How dare he cut me off? I wanted to chase him and cut him off.
Yeah, he's all amped up. The adrenaline's pumping and he's going for
and it. And it's in his self-talk. It's guiding that pump up. The self-talk is, no one can do this to me. I've been aggrieved. And so with someone like that in therapy, you challenge that cognition after you build a rapport. You say, is it really true everybody's after you? Or is it that there might be an alternative explanation? Just possibly. I'm not telling you to change it. I'm just saying, can we look at alternatives? Just possible ideas just to throw around, you and me, right? And so then you help them shift their cognition. And then the next time he's out, if somebody cuts him off, that guy says, oh, I used to think everybody was just doing it to insult me. And it's just some random knucklehead, you know, who's just not being responsible. I don't need to be a part of that. See how the cognition change produces behavior change? I mean, it's huge.
It's huge. And you can see how that could apply to Parkinson's, especially when you're first diagnosed and you're, why me? And you're drinking and you can't find the answer at the bottom of the bottle. At least I couldn't. If somebody else does, let me know. But I was looking for it. It wasn't there.
Well, you were trying to adapt. That's what we all find ourselves doing. And then if we use our language to really talk about stuff and really find groups that we can be a part of, right? Like when I go into my boxing group, I box four times a week, right? And I go to my boxing group, the quality of cohesion after maybe 3-4 years of the same core group is powerful.
Yeah.
The cohesion of that group, one day I said, well, why don't we go to breakfast after this? So once a month, we go to breakfast. Everybody, and we have a great time, and everybody feels less anxious about their Parkinson's because they're with like members of their tribe. They share a complete identification, and then they want to grow into being persons with Parkinson's, not I'm Parkinson's. That's how you feel in the beginning. I'm done.
I think your life's over.
That's right. Game over. And then you work through that grief of losing that state. And then you find that you can come into another state. You know, that's the beauty of successful grieving. It's like death or loss. People who grieve fully, like their parents die, right? They get older. People who grieve fully are able to move on because they've really let it go. Because they work through this stuff. They've had the courage to talk about it. It takes confidence and courage to be in counseling or to be in a group when you have felt really isolated in your diagnosis. And then if they work it through, then Parkinson's becomes this, Larry, you know, like this. It doesn't become this.
That's great. So you're putting your hands close together and farther apart there.
Yes.
Just for our listening audience.
That's right. Yeah. Right.
I know you're talking to me and it's great, but they don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, let's translate this, man.
Let's see. Have you seen any positive shifts in public attitudes towards Parkinson's stigma in recent years?
Yeah, I have.
Like what?
Well, I'll tell you, the doctors, so let's start with the people who treat us, right? The doctors are slowly, begrudgingly entertaining and realizing as the research is getting out there, right, about social and about, you know, individualized medicine. And do you know that nobody, until recently, nobody was even aware of shame as a central dynamic? It's amazing, right? Because people even hear the word shame, they get shameful. You know, it's just powerful, right?
It's a powerful word, yeah.
It's a powerful word, and it's just a natural human emotion. It evolved to tell us, it's evolutionary. It came about, like all emotions, because it served a function. It was cueing us to do something different, to get back into the tribe, right? Because we used to, 100,000 years ago, we used to, you know, rely on the tribe to be safe, to be survived. And that's still a part of us because we're all social animals, man.
Well, and unfortunately, still today in parts of Africa and Asia, there are tribes that are banishing people with Parkinson's, saying they're witches or they've been cursed. And
we have our history with that, with the witches as well, right?
Yeah. So thank you, Salem. I think that what's interesting as we begin to wrap up here. I go back to like when I first was diagnosed and the idea of telling people that I'm not perfectly healthy.
That's right.
But that I'm not that image that they thought I was, and that I had all these plans in front of me that are now poof.
Gone in an instant.
And you're like, what the? And so there's this, it's like, it's overwhelming. You don't know, like there's so many things going on in your head at that point. Like it's, you just want to shut down.
And I tell you, that's so well said, Larry, because you know what? The shock is the first stage, right? Your whole assumptive world, all your assumptions you had about yourself and your world are trashed. And so then you have to grieve that. And then if you grieve that, then what starts to happen? It's like after I grieved it, then I was, you know, Dr. Mishley, right? Laurie Mishley asked me to come out and speak, you know? And I started to do groups and spoke at the summer camp and doing things on resiliency and the research on resiliency and shame and Parkinson's. So I was able to get something out of it that was helpful to others and helpful to me. Probably more helpful to me, you know?
Yeah, right. That's amazing. Well, you know, every time you teach, you learn more than the students.
No, always. Always. That's so funny, Larry. I had a client yesterday who said to me, I have this book, you know, that you should know about. And it was this really great book on exercise and Parkinson's. It just came out. And I said, thank you. And she goes, yeah, see, I can give you stuff to read too. That's somebody who's done the work. Okay, she can
say. That's somebody who's done the work, right. How long does it take to do the work?
Depends on the person's motivation and their proneness to guilt and shame, right? I mean, some people just feel a little, some of it, because they get a Parkinson's diagnosis and it's a mind blower in the beginning. Other people have a long history of guilt and shame, you know, that maybe they had, you know, family dynamics that were pretty tough.
Yeah, they're weak if they're sick or.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's like, that's right. It's like they, but the good news is, it's an opportunity to change, right? Like my initial reaction was just to just not think about it because I was still, you know, perfectly, you know, I just diagnosed. I mean, I had a little bit of a tremor and that was it. You know, I didn't have the swallowing and all the other stuff that I've had to deal with. But just that, you know, you blank it out, you just repress it. And then, you know, then what happens is you find your way, you know, you start reaching out and having support to take risk, because that's one of the three factors, right? It's positive social orientation, willingness to take risk, you know, and internal locus of control is what the research shows, which is versus the external locus of control. Internal locus of control is I am the agent of me. Resiliency is my choice or not. External locus of control, where we all start, is how could this happen to me? There's nothing I can do. I'm a passive leaf blowing in the wind. I have no agency. So we got to get to internal locus of control. And then it's like you and I sit here talking about this stuff. We're like, you know, let's get into it, right? We have an internal locus of control. And that can be developed and learned. That's what the research said. That can be developed and learned.
I could talk to you all day, Dr. Bagoni, but tell me, give me, what am I missing? What's one thing you want to impart to people as we move forward into this four-part series on stigma?
To realize that stigma is inevitable. We don't have to like it. We matter of fact, we should hate it. But we have to do what it takes to get ourselves in a self-acceptance state so that we can be more available to help other people with their Parkinson's.
That's great. Thank you very much for being here and being the first guest. That's great.
Yeah, that's cool. I like that.
And that's a wrap for today's episode of On Time, the podcast by the Brian Grant Foundation. Thanks so much for tuning in and joining us on this insightful exploration of Parkinson's stigma. Please join us next time for episode 2, when I speak to two women from the Women's Parkinson's Project about Parkinson's stigma for women. We hope today's discussion has provided valuable insights and sparked meaningful conversations. Remember, tackling stigma is a collective effort, and every voice matters in creating a more understanding and supportive community for those living with Parkinson's. Until next time, be well, stay informed, and remember, together we can make a difference in the fight against Parkinson's stigma. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on Time.
The Brian Grant Foundation empowers people impacted by Parkinson's to lead active and fulfilling lives. Help support our efforts at briangrant.org. A special thank you to Raphael Sadiq for providing the music for this podcast. This podcast is produced by Brian Griggs. Learn more at griggsproductions.com.